From Lexington, Kentucky, the horse capital of the world, of the solar system, maybe even the universe, the Gorilla Media Network, The Reynolds Reveal, the new weekly show that sifts and winnows without fear or favor. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and it is June 25, 2013, and this is episode number 19 of The Reynolds Reveal. Why am I in Lexington, Kentucky? Because my favorite motorcycle club is here for the big national rally, and the roads are great, if dangerous. I've had a couple of days of wild motorcycling, but no crashing and no harm, but it's been fun. I spent 2 hours in seemed like a flood, a deluge, where face shield is all steamed up, the glasses are steamed up. Try to look over the glasses. My eyes are getting pelted with rain. I'm looking for a refuge in that storm. It's been crazy. Lots of good friends here. And Lexington, Kentucky is a very pleasant place. Last week, my guest was Eric Larson. And I first learned of him when he did the foreword to Where Did the Towers Go? And that has a lot to do with my guest, my special guest, but more of that in a few minutes. And Eric Larson was my guest last week. He writes beautifully, and he is such a nice person, it turns out. And he cares deeply about his country, and he's a novelist and, among other things, the author of A Nation Gone Blind. And we had a wide-ranging interview. We talked about psychopathy, Shakespeare. I was interested to find out he doesn't believe that Shakespeare was the author of the works attributed to him. It was the Earl of Oxford. All kinds of interesting things, but 9/11 was the main thing, and the gatekeepers of the left that he is written so wisely about. My guest today is Dr. Judy Wood, who many of our listeners, I think, are familiar with to one extent or another. And I want to give a brief bio, which is available, among other places, on her principal website, drjudywood.com. She holds a Bachelor's of Science in Civil Engineering, 1981. Principal specialty is structural engineering, a master's in engineering mechanics, or we can certainly label it applied physics, 1983, and a PhD in materials engineering science, 1992, from, I just call it Virginia Tech, because, hey, they are an important football program in Blacksburg, Virginia. She did a stint of some years on the mechanical engineering faculty or department at Clemson University, where she co-authored many engineering articles, some 60, and she is uniquely qualified to investigate what happened at the World Trade Center because of her experience and research interest in things like experimental stress analysis, structural mechanics, optical methods, deformation analysis, materials characterization of biomaterials, composite materials. You know, the bottom line on her bio page, in my words, would say the official story about 9/11 is BS, start to finish. And her book of the century, Where Did the Towers Go?, is proof positive. Every page is about evidence, really irrefutable evidence. Welcome to the Reynolds Reveal, Dr. Judy Wood.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I've got to add, of course, toot Reynolds' horn here. I had the privilege of helping her at, we'll call it, the middle stage of her investigation. And, you know, one of the great things about that book is it helps teach us all how to think. And the reason we need to do more on 9/11 is apparent in two news items I want to bring up right away. Here the other day from The Guardian, the NSA, they did a story on the NSA, the National Security Agency, Director Keith Alexander, and the heading was NSA Director Edward Snowden has caused irreversible damage to the United States. And Keith Alexander, with all of his ribbons and military decor, defends his agency's broad surveillance as being in line with Americans' expectations for preventing another 9/11. So 9/11 is the root of so much evil consequences in the world. And here's a second article that I think is, I was struck by how little I know. One, Leonid Bershinsky in Moscow. The article is headlined, U.S. Surveillance is Not Aimed at Terrorists. And this was run by Bloomberg on June 23. The author's allegedly an editor and novelist based in Moscow. And what he, and you may know, Dr. Wood, something about this, but in the article they said, you know, Google only surveys or makes available 0.04% of the internet. And there's this deep internet, if you will, with core groups where the terrorists hang out, supposedly. And whereas most websites, of course, want to be highly visible, off visited, maybe sell you something or inform you of something. And so, in other words, this net that the NSA, Snowden has illuminated us about, seems to be directed at law-abiding ordinary citizens. And here they are. What they're doing is missing the target completely, according to this article. So in any case, 9/11 importance has diminished at all. Dr. Wood.
Yeah, let me interrupt here, if that's okay. I don't know about this undernet business, but what I do know is if somebody's going to commit a crime, they leave paper trails to their door. You know, the safest place to talk is in a lead line meat locker.
Yeah.
So you know, there's no surveillance.
Sense, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, I understand that when folks are discussing something, what they're going to do, they do a face-to-face, and they don't even let their lips get read by any cameras.
Yeah, that reminds me of Phil Carlson on I Led Three Lives, where they were always talking. He was an FBI undercover agent, you know, in communist cells back in the old days, 1950s. But yes, to be sure, go ahead.
Well, just that you know, terrorists aren't going to be posting their plans on the internet. This is so stupid.
It is. It is.
Let's rob a bank, and let's put our discuss it on a forum of how we're going to rob the bank. That's silly.
Let's turn to. Where did the towers go? I think we need to do some content. And I just finished watching much, maybe I didn't finish the Q&A session of your talk, your slideshow, and it had a lot of content I didn't know about, over in Holland in 2012. Mm-hmm. And you listed WTC data issues and proof of concept. There was a lot of ground you covered. And if we look at the top, I'd like you to have you, because some listeners aren't very familiar with your work, I think we need to review a little bit of this, the powerful evidence that you have uncovered. And you listed 20 things. Number one was lack of debris. Number two was bathtub. Number three, seismic impact. Number four, dustification. I'd like you to comment about that, because those are I don't know. I guess it's obvious to me. On hindsight, maybe it's too much hindsight, but those are powerful things.
Yeah, it's so, you know, obvious. And that's really all you need for proving anything is any one of those first three things. But the rest is just, you know, more things of interest. But the biggest issue is, why don't more people see it? That is the biggest puzzle. I mean, I saw it right on day one, and my colleagues around me were already sucked into this whatever. You know, people are more comfortable believing what people tell them rather than what they observe themselves. That's just
Don't believe your lying eyes, as the attorney would say in court, huh? Don't believe your lying eyes. People don't trust their own mind, I guess.
And so I'd like to go into a little bit more, but first, it's, you know, very simply stated, the towers didn't burn up, nor did they slam to the ground. They turned into dust in midair. And we know that because of there's three main pieces of evidence. One is, if they'd slammed to the ground, you see a pile of stuff left over, you know, a pile of debris. Where'd it go?
A huge pile. Would we see 110 stories stacked up, more or less? I mean, it would be unmistakable.
Instead, there's an ambulance parked in front of the front door that's still there afterwards. Doesn't even look clobbered. But where's the building? You can see right through the complex at ground level. And, you know, Roadrunner even survived. The statue of Roadrunner, the underground was not destroyed. Zero damage, but it
wasn't
destroyed.
Yeah, the underground levels of the towers.
The thing is, if these buildings, 500,000 tons each, if they'd slammed to the ground, Lower Manhattan would have been flooded because all the subways that connect down in there, and, you know, would have water would have been all over the place, because few people realize that the towers were actually built in the Hudson River on bedrock that's 70 feet, that's 7 times 10, 70 feet below the water table. And to keep it, you know, dried down into the basement, they had a dike around it. So if you're dropping two half million ton buildings onto this dike, for sure you're going to rupture it. Didn't happen. And the third thing, this is the most significant, is if you'd slammed 2 500,000-ton buildings onto bedrock, not to mention the 230,000-ton building across the street, Building 7, and several other buildings. You know, there were 7 buildings destroyed that day. But if you slam these buildings down onto the bedrock, that bedrock would be like, it'd be like ringing a tuning fork. And the seismic station at the other end of that bedrock would have recorded it. The seismic station did not record a signal that traveled through the earth. It only recorded surface waves. And when you get an earthquake, you get surface waves and signals that travel through the earth. When you blow up a building with controlled demolition, you get surface waves and waves that travel through the earth. There's two kinds of waves that travel through the earth, S waves and P waves. P, the primary wave, is the first to arrive. S, the shear wave, is secondary to arrive. And they travel at different speeds. So the lag time of their arrival, because the P wave gets there first and then the S wave arrives, the time between those two will tell you how far away the epicenter is. Well, there was no S wave or P wave associated with the demise of the buildings, only a surface wave.
Now, they had multiple seismographic data sensors, and they would all identify at different distances the same event, right?
Right. You'd have various seismic stations all over the place, and they, you know, pick it up at different speeds and different gaps between the speeds, and you can figure out where the epicenter is based on that if it travels through the earth. But this did not travel through the earth.
What about the argument? Has anybody, I suppose on the internet, since there's a little bit of everything, I know, who was it, September Clues or his crowd, is saying that you can't trust these data, you know, the seismic data. And yet, if the fix was in, you'd fix the data, you'd corrupt the scientists somehow, so as to reinforce the collapse story. And yet it doesn't. These data do not support the collapse story. Have you encountered these negative responders on this on the data?
It's a desperation to distract people. It's like saying, well, what happens if everything you've perceived in your life is non-existent and you're really blind and you just imagine everything? Right. Well, you know, if all of the data is consistent with all of the images, and the images are from a variety of different sources, you know, they like to say that the images are all fake. Are you saying that they drove in a truckload of dust and with a big fan blew it all over Manhattan and then erased everybody's memory or recollection of that having happened? Well, they disappeared the towers. It starts getting pretty ludicrous.
It's preposterous, yeah.
Yet these same people claim the building was taken down by bombs in the building, but they have no evidence for that.
It's just amazing how persistent, but I guess it's true of JFK's assassination and on, all these events.
It's more,
some of these
more
trolls. Yes,
right, it's
ahead.
More tricky than that, and I've gotten into this more. But back to the seismic thing, the only thing that was recorded essentially was the surface waves, which you would get if you removed that loading on the ground. If you picked up each of the 500,000-ton buildings and just lifted them up and blew them away in the wind, you're unloading the ground. You're unloading that bedrock, and it's going to rebound, and that would cause a surface wave. So it's consistent with that.
Oh.
So, like, if King Kong reached over and grabbed each of the towers and just chucked them into outer space, you're taking that load off. It's like when you get up off your mattress in the morning, it rebounds. Or getting off the sofa, it rebounds because it no longer has your weight on it.
So that would be enough, but would that be enough to give a reading of this high, if that makes sense, for the surface wave just disappearing the building? That would create a surface wave from the ground,
right.
the pressure on the ground being released.
Right, and that wave dampened out for the North Tower, dampened out in 8 seconds. Now, it takes 9.5 seconds to drop a bowling ball off the roof and have it hit the ground. But the ground only shook for 8 seconds. In other words, that building could not have fallen to the ground.
It's just staggering, Dr. Wood. Fact after fact refutes all these other ideas or theories of what happened because they're inconsistent with the evidence. The evidence, which is unshakable. You are listening to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and our special guest today is the woman of the century with the book of the century. So you need to learn more. Come on back and rejoin us after the break.
This is Dr. Judy Wood, author of Where Did the Towers Go? And you're listening to the Guerrilla Media Network.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And we do welcome your calls here at the Guerrilla Media Network. The number 218-862-9829. My guest today is Dr. Judy Wood. Well known now for her fabulous book, Where Did the Towers Go? What has the day everything went wrong in the 21st century, and we're reaping were collapses, and the surface wave only lasted 8 seconds. So pick up there and tell us more.
Okay, and so that already rules out bombs in the basement or something that cutter charges slicing and dicing the building and then crashing into the ground. Typical controlled demolitions, they slice and dice the building, slam it to the ground, and it doesn't get busted up until it slams to the ground. And you'd still have the building slamming to the ground. And that didn't happen. So we can rule that out, as well as ruling out bombs in the basement. You know, explosives, traveled through the bedrock and so forth, and they would leave S and P waves. But this did not. We even have, like, Building 7, There's a video of a woman being interviewed, and right over her shoulder, she, you know, it's the back of her, Building 7 starts dropping. And the interviewer or the photographer, I don't know which, suddenly when the building's halfway down, it says, whoa, 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 whoa. And, you know, nobody's even aware of it. They don't hear anything.
Yeah, it's so quiet.
He just knows the building's dropping behind
it.
Right. It just kind of shrinks
up. We have Ryan on line one who would like to speak with Dr. Judy Wood. Ryan, are you there?
Hi, Dr. Reynolds. I was muted.
There you go, Ryan.
I was just,
you're all set.
Muted. I had to unmute myself.
Okay, go ahead, Ryan.
Well, I mean, I'm really interested about the conversation. It's really great. I really support Dr. Wood. I think she, her book, Where Did the Towers Go, is a must read. I think everybody needs to know that information because there's a weaponry that's really more powerful than anybody can imagine, and it's practically silent.
And there's plenty of
I was wondering what Dr. Wood thought about the smart meter situation. Has she heard about that?
Yes, that's
Dr. Wood.
That's sort of like part two. We're going to talk about that more at the end.
Absolutely. I don't want to cut in. I was really interested in the discussion. Yeah.
Oh, great. Great. That's fantastic.
He's anticipating. Ryan's anticipating.
Right. He
I only learned
going.
About the other day. Pardon?
Yes,
go ahead,
he knows
Dr.
where
Wood.
It's going. Where it follows
well, thank
from.
Thank you. Please continue. I'll come back later, I guess.
Okay, thanks.
Call back later in the show when that comes up.
So the issue is that it's so obvious why do so many people have trouble seeing what happened. And I've come to some newer revelations since I talked with you. But first of all, I've put into three categories what keeps people from seeing what happened. Number one, problem-solving skills, poor problem-solving skills. Number two, groupthink. People like to go with, you know, peer pressure. They like to get herded, and they feel safe if they're doing what everybody else is doing. Kind of like I've got a picture of a flock of birds taken off, and I bet you only one of them knows why they're flying up. You know, they all go together because it's survival instinct. And then the third thing is they're terrified of the implications. That has become more significant recently. But the first thing, the problem solving, few people realize my book is not about a theory. My book is about what happened. It doesn't contain speculation, and there's no speculation in my work. And so it's about, you know, the evidence of what happened. Actually, the beginning of my author's preface, I state the order of crime solving is to first determine what happened, and only then can you determine how it happened. How can you determine how it happened if you don't know what it is? And then number three, who did it? Number four, why they did it. And I'd like to remind listeners of the Casey Anthony trial. The prosecutors had failed to determine what happened, so they didn't have a case. You know, what's the crime? I don't know. You have to define what happened before you can say how it happened and who did it and why they did it. So that's so important, and so many people overlook that. And that is a huge thing because the secret to cover-ups, as far as I can tell, the main technique, just like with magic shows, is to get people to assume what happened and argue about how it happened before they determine what it is. They subconsciously assume what it was that happened without determining what it was. So they argue about their perception of how it could have happened, and you get this argument about opinions, of speculation, of opinions, of hearsay, of whatever, round and round, round and round, round, and it will never be solved, ever. You cannot solve it until you determine what it is. So my book is about what happened. And I don't know if, Dr. Reynolds, do you have a book on you?
Andy, no, I don't, because I'm on the road, so I don't have
okay.
a copy handy.
Pete, could you
maybe,
read the
maybe
last...
Maybe Pete does.
Yeah, could you read for us the last paragraph of the author's preface? It's a short one. It's at on page XXXIII, halfway down the page. It's just a three-line paragraph.
Okay. And you see the last paragraph. Is that correct? On XXXIII?
Yep.
Okay. So let us consider the body of empirical evidence that must be explained in order to determine what happened. What is presented here is not a theory, and it is not speculation. It is evidence. Here, then, is the evidence of what happened on 9/11/01.
You know, a great term that Dr. Wood uses, too, is it's a comprehensive forensic investigation.
Right, of what happened. And the only way people can marginalize it is to refer to it as a theory or an opinion or, you know, Judy Wood's views or thought, ideas. Mm-hmm. And, no, this is evidence. And the reason why my book cannot be refuted is because evidence cannot be refuted. Evidence is what is. And another phrase I like to use is, Yogi agrees too, let the evidence lead to the conclusions and not let the conclusions color the evidence. So you have to start with the evidence and lead to the conclusions.
And this isn't controversial, I would argue, because criminal investigations work that way. And maybe they're dramatized on CSI, on television, but everybody knows you got to start by looking at the evidence.
Exactly. And for those who claim it was thermite, well, what was thermite? What is it that was thermite? You know, the buildings turned dust and midair. How does thermite have anything to do with it? Thermite's a welding material, and it gets hot, really hot. Well, you know, there's no evidence of this. You need to have evidence that leads to that, and there's no evidence that leads to that. It's like saying, you know, the ingredients of chocolate chip cookies were found in the dust, and therefore chocolate chip cookies destroyed the buildings. Well, you need to prove how chocolate chip cookies can do what was done. So what happened and defining what happened is the most important thing.
And blinding light is really required to ignite thermite, correct? You know, it's such a high temperature required. That came up in your Holland talk.
Yeah. Blinded by the light. I think that was something that was missing on 9/11.
It was missing in so many ways. You are listening to The Reynolds Reveal, and we are interviewing Dr. Judy Wood, the famous author of Where Did the Towers Go? And we will return after the break with more evidence. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we do welcome calls here at the Guerrilla Media Network. The number, 218-862-9829. Our guest today, Dr. Judy Wood, author of Where Did the Towers Go.com. Please buy that book and drop the shades from your eyes and the illusions of or your assumptions about what happened on 9/11. Now, Dr. Wood, you've hit some very important points here about your from your analysis. What strikes you as next in line? I know you like toasted cars, for one. Should you talk about that? Or
I'd like to finish the three things that impede people from seeing what happened. And because the evidence isn't all that tricky, it's getting people to see the evidence right in front of them is the tricky part. And the problem-solving skills is one thing, and that is how cover-ups work. Get people to start arguing about how it happened before they've determined what it is, and they'll just go round, 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 round circles and not ever solve it. It's like a magic show where people assume what the problem is and move on with that without noticing what really happened. And that's why they get tricked. That's why they think it's magic. Now, groupthink, that's pretty evident. People feel safe if they go with the herd. Even if the herd's going in the wrong direction, they still feel safe and they don't care. But the terrified of the implications, I discovered this early on, what the issue was, without really putting the name to it, when I came up with my billiard ball example. it's actually what I thought of on day one. To, you know, am I crazy or is the rest of the world crazy? And so I said, well, gee, how long should it take? And I'm thinking of, you know, first I was thinking of an avalanche from a snowstorm where this moves and then it gets that part moving, and it gets that part moving. You don't have a building just start moving all at once. That's just weird. But the billiard ball thing is like you can't get the next floor moving until the one above has hit it to trigger it to move. And if it, when it hits it, it turns to dust. It goes splat, and you see all this dust coming out. You don't have an accumulated mass pushing this, you know, like a pile driver pushing things down. And sure enough, you don't see any pile driver at the end. The floors are getting destroyed as it goes, and there's just nothing left. So that doesn't make sense for this paradox of you have resistance of something splatting into something else, but then where it doesn't have enough energy to trigger the next floor. But why do people see that, especially colleagues who teach dynamics at a college level? And then when I wrote up my billiard ball example, not a theory, it's an example. What it does is you step outside of, you know, the flying bodies, the horror scene, everything that people have been trained to think of as, you know, this terrorizing event, and just have these innocent billiard balls that people can focus on. Then their brain works and they can think. And it, that was just, you know, miraculous. So I showed it to one of my colleagues in particular. And he was working through it like a, you know, professor grading a student's paper. Yeah, he saw what, you know, assumptions I made and how I put it together. And he worked his way down, you know, case 1, 2, 3, 4. And then pretty soon he realized he'd painted himself into a corner that he couldn't get out of. There was only one conclusion he'd come to, and he was real uncomfortable. Because at that point, you step back to the real problem. As long as it's this billiard ball thing over here, innocent billiard balls, has nothing to do with it, reality, you know. And then he realized what it means. It's scary as all get out. And he got really mad and he said, well, it takes a cynical person to do a thing like this. You know, the paper.
He wasn't appraised early on that it had 9/11 applications, so he realized it during the process?
Oh, no, I told him beginning.
Oh, you told him at the outset.
Right, but then he was started focusing and getting drawn into watching the billiard balls, innocent billiard balls, and then just checking the math from these. He saw how they made the assumptions, okay, and then looking through the math, he wasn't looking at the big picture until he was painted into a corner. And then the big picture hit him, and yeah, oh, I mean, it's like it short-circuited everything. And that's...
He wanted nothing more to do with it, right.
Right, it scared the heck out of him. He was... sort of, you know, walked himself into this backwards without realizing where he was going. You know, literally like painting himself in a corner. And looking back on that, I now realize more what was going on and why the billiard ball example is so powerful because of that. Think of this. I was listening recently to a talk by Neil Sanders and Richard Hall, who's a fellow, I guess they're both British. And Neil Sanders' area of study has been trauma-based mind control and schizophrenia, and how if somebody is really traumatized, their personality kind of splits. So they can kind of do something, you know, they can be separated from the horror. So they can be in one sense, you know, familiar with the horror, and then another sense, it's a totally different person they know nothing about. And it's become more clear to me that is what happened on a worldwide scale on 9/11. As I say, I've often said it was an attack on human consciousness. I think it was trauma-based mind control, in effect, for the general population. That why people cannot deal with the reality of it. And it's a separate part of their personality. They separated out, like this professor who I was showing the billiard ball example to. He could follow that down. It made perfect sense. And he got into the corner where he had to step back and see, you know, what happened on 9/11. It just freaked him out. He could not handle that. And so if right at the onset, you know, if you start showing somebody the timing with the floors and all, not the billiard balls, they're not going anywhere. They cannot... assimilate it. They can't. It is too difficult. It's equivalent to, you know, the worst horror scene for a child, and why that causes them to you know totally avoid a certain area of their personality.
Now you're making an explanation that has appeal. Eric Larson and I think I are immediately judgmental. In other words, this is part of the lying to yourself, a nation of liars, and a lack of courage. It's just very disappointing. It makes me angry. Now, I know most of my colleagues in the academy don't have much courage, but it's just very it's sad. And the only way out of that to live with yourself happily is to turn to the truth. How do you react to that?
It really is a split personality type issue from what I've seen recently. I was talking to a neighbor who, you know, I've gotten to know him pretty well, that he wants life as it used to be, everything nice. So he keeps referring to the evidence I present as my views, and everybody is entitled to their own views, and everybody's views are correct because everybody's entitled to their own opinion. Well, facts aren't opinion, but he needs it to be that way. He's not stupid. He can see through it, but he cannot handle it, I think. So that it becomes, this way of rationalizing, just splitting it off, that part. At times he's understood it, but then he just totally forgets that he ever understood it. And it'll be ways of rationalizing and rationalizing.
Yeah, philosophically, it's an escape into subjectivism and trying to deny objective reality or closing your eyes to it, that segment of it that makes you uncomfortable. It's just sad.
And one of the recent talks we had, he said, well, this country is just going through another cycle. You know, the pendulum swings back and forth. It'll be swing back the other way, and you know, soon, and everything will be fine again.
Good luck with that. What did Richard Hall contribute to your understanding?
Well, it was this discussion with Neil Sanders on Richard Hall's show, and he went into a lot of this mind control business and how trauma really causes people's personalities to split. And I've heard of that before. In terms of schizophrenia, where they have distinct personalities, and that is their way of coping with horrible situations. And then, you know, it just hits you in the face that seems to be what happened on 9/11. Why on earth would people say, well, you know, let's allow them to do all of this with the, you know, frisking at the airports and taking away all our rights, because it's a trauma-based mind control, where they can stop and realize it's just so stupid. Like someone recently pointed out, I think Jesse Ventura also pointed out, the big frisking lines at the airports, if somebody wanted to, suicide bomber wanted to take out a bunch of people, he just stands in line and makes his bomb go.
And, right.
And you take out a lot more people than on an airplane. He doesn't need to go through the security check to do it. So it's, you know, hey, I'm not advising that, but I'm just pointing out the logic. If you look through the logic of this, it doesn't add up. And people are not that stupid, so what is keeping them from seeing it? It's got to be this other, a type of trauma-based mind control. They're so convinced. Like, they saw the airplanes, so therefore the airplanes caused the buildings to disintegrate. But these are structural engineers I'm talking to. And you start asking questions, and they get really uncomfortable because they don't want to let go of it.
I can remember that morning. Somebody had their TV in the U.S. Department of Labor on, and there's something going on at the World Trade Center. So you see this building and a hole in it and some black pufferies coming out. And I looked at that, and I said, that building will not fall. Okay, in other words, this is ridiculous.
and then it turns to dust.
it turned to dust instead, which I didn't realize till you pointed this out years later. But it's just, how do you feel about, we'll call it the awakening, making progress on, you want to grab somebody and say, can't you see? look at this. This is turning to dust.
Right, but look back at the billiard ball example. You know, just saying the evidence to a professor who teaches dynamics, you tell him the evidence that the ground only shook for 8 seconds, that it takes 9.5 seconds to drop a billiard ball off the roof, he would say, well, that's the way it happened, so therefore it happened. You know, he'll go around every which way, every possible argument to keep the official story intact, because the implications of anything else are just too terrifying. And so if I think maybe I'm just thinking out loud here, but going by way of my billiard ball thing, doing something else, you know, parallel. Somebody can understand the parallel story, but then that jump back to the reality, it's too much for people. But still, that gets them to
cognitive dissonance is one way to look at it. I was talking to Eric Larson, and then in a prior show, Veronica Chapman, and the idea comes up about these are psychopaths at the top. LBJ is my number one example, but George W. Bush, I can make a strong case. The guy's a psychopath. In other words, he doesn't have any moral center. He doesn't have empathy for others. And I think that is a problem where people say, well, the top of our government or, domestic powers that be would never do this. So they dismiss that whole possibility out of hand and hope for some resolution, some kind of logical explanation for the evidence you're bringing to bear. They just can't. I'd never. That can't be.
It's about 8 years ago. I had a conversation with this colleague of mine. I was on campus, and they said, "But they understand the billiard ball issue." They said, "But no human being is that evil." I said, "Oh, but Bin Laden is. I guess he's not a human."
Right. In other words, they find it plausible in this other allegation, other context, but not over here. It's just amazing.
Right. And I love what Jesse Ventura said about we should have captured Bin Laden to find out what kind of technology he has to do this. Sarcastically.
Yeah, he's a great ally of this. And I consider him an absolutely wonderful personality and a true seeker and a truth teller. He's a straight guy. Don't you think so?
Oh, yeah. He might, tone back talking about something, but he does not lie. Yes. You know, like if his audience just can't handle it, he might, turn back the knob a few notches and not go there as much. But he will not lie and agree that, it was thermite, it was bombs in the building, it was jets that did, whatever that he knows is not true. He won't agree to that just to please the audience. He'll just not talk about it if they can't handle anything else. And that's a good skill, too.
He was giving a talk in Little Rock, and I went over and I was hearing some people talk about, well, he's kind of a conspiracy theorist or whatever. And he, in 45 minutes, he didn't look at a note. He charmed the pants off everybody. He had the whole audience, and it was a large group, maybe 400. He just was amazing.
He is excellent at that, at reaching people and not, overdosing them on anything. It's anything more than they can take. And I think that's a great skill in itself. But the issue of referring to this as views or, what's in my book as views or theory or, that's her theory. Her theory is blah, blah, blah. What? Somebody needs me to have a theory, so they're assigning me a theory?
Well, you do touch on the proof of concept, right? You're saying, we've got some incredible, unusual effects here, and
right.
There's got to be an explanation, or we've got to be able to improve our understanding of what caused these effects. And you look around, and in other words, you're saying, one way to put it is proof of concept
parallel.
Parallel. Yeah. What is there any precedent for this? And then so you go off on the hunt, and that's a bunch of facts too, correct?
Exactly. Like tornadoes. You know, let's observe what tornadoes can do. They do blah, blah, blah. I think it's funny when, like, Greg Jenkins, you know, is saying, well, you have to, you know, say how much, you have to calculate how much energy it would be required to, you know, dustify the towers. But why? To prove that the towers are gone or they're still there? Just go look.
Yeah, I mean, to an economist, that is such a dumb idea, you know, that
That's like saying in 1966 when a tornado went through Topeka, Kansas and did the most horrendous damage of any tornado we'd had in this country. You can't say the tornado did that damage until you calculate how much energy was required. It's the equivalent. You know, you see, a tornado went through and here's the damage. You know, this technology, call it Acme product XYZ, whatever you want to call it. There's a gizmo that did something, and here's what happened. So that's proof that this gizmo exists. Because
speaking of tornadoes, I was watching the Weather Channel. We had the loss of 24 lives in Moore, Oklahoma, south of Oklahoma City, and they look at the evidence, and then after that assessment, they decide whether it was an FE1 up through 5 is the highest, the most devastating. So they look at the facts. That's the way they proceed.
Let the evidence lead to the conclusions.
Yes.
And, so here I'm showing you what in my book what tornadoes do. I'm showing you what John Hutchison has done. I'm showing you what George Pigott has done. I'm showing you what Thomas Townsend Brown has done, what Tesla is, you know, said to have done, and a lot of different examples. Also, I show examples of, you know, hot things glow, but not everything that glows is hot. An incandescent light versus a fluorescent light. One glow, you know, they both glow, but they glow. One's hot and one's not. I'm not saying a fluorescent light destroyed the towers. That's not a theory that, you know, just because it's in my book.
Yeah.
Or I'm not saying that George Pigott destroyed the towers, because that's in my book, and on and on. I'm just showing parallel evidence of concepts, because this is a book of evidence of what is known. The book came out before the Texas tornado a little over a year ago on April 3rd, where you had those flying truck bodies.
Oh, and, you know, I saw that for the first time on your website, the tape of your Holland 2012 talk. I hadn't seen that. So go on.
It was interesting that these truck, you know, trailers, not the engine part, but the trailers, went up, way up, like, you know, 700 feet up. And then they fall out of the field and then they come down. And they didn't crash as hard as if they were just dropped, because they didn't completely get destroyed. You know, some, of course, did, but then there are other ones that were just, you know, did a belly flop upside down and were gently set down. And we do hear about various weird things in tornadoes of people getting lifted up and set down elsewhere. You've seen a car ends up in a tree, undamaged, but it's just sitting in a tree. But why is it cars? And also, you have tornadoes that are well known for going after trailer parks, which brings up this thing about Moore, Oklahoma, that this community is the third time a tornado has wiped them out, and there's got to be something there that tornadoes like. Well, they don't have basements in those houses either. Kind of interesting coincidence. So you start looking at various, you know, concepts that you know. And another thing I often say is know what you know, and know that everything else you don't know. Don't fill that gap in with speculation and mix that in with what you know, because you then have nothing. You just have all, if it's jumbled up together, you don't know what you know anymore. It's okay to step aside and try out something in a separate box, like the billiard ball thing. But I'm not saying the towers are made out of billiard balls, and that's not getting mixed into there. But if you know various concepts, like, okay, we see from the World Trade Center data, you see something glowing sitting on a piece of paper. Well, how hot can it be if the paper's not burning? But we know it's glowing. So just because it's glowing, let's not assume it's hot. But then here's in a parallel box over here, we have fluorescent lights and incandescent lights. So we know that things can glow without being hot. So then you step back, and that's, you know, sort of validating evidence that this is a concept that is indeed true, that something can glow.
Yeah.
Without being hot.
It's not outside the norms or the current physical paradigm, right? It doesn't challenge that.
But you know that you know that you know it. I mean, from various aspects, it's something that becomes very consistent. You know, all the unburned paper that was blowing all over Manhattan. You know, if the building burned up, it was the super hot heat. Why isn't there burn up paper around?
You are listening to The Reynolds Reveal, and I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. Our special guest today, Dr. Judy Wood. We are getting an education in many ways, how to think in a straight line about the facts, how to assemble the facts, how to get to the bottom of official lies. So come on back after the break and learn more.
This is Dr. Judy Wood, author of Where Did the Towers Go? And you're listening to the Guerrilla Media Network.
Ever ask yourself, where do the towers go? Well, if you want the truth, if you can handle the truth, tune in Thursdays and Fridays from 5 till 7 Pacific Coast Time. Dr. Judy Wood is doing a program called ICU PSYOP Recovery Program, addressing your questions, your curiosities, your mysteries regarding that fateful day. So it's a character-driven production on Guerrilla Media Network, 5 to 7, Thursdays and Friday evenings, Pacific Coast Time. If you can handle the truth, tune in.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and yes, we do welcome your calls. The number 218-862-9829. My special guest today, Dr. Judy Wood, the brave and brilliant one who's led us out of the mental darkness regarding 9/11. And Dr. Wood, you've addressed a number of things on 9/11. And I know, as I said earlier, that toasted cars are a special interest. So let's go there and talk toasted cars.
Great. And why I like to call them toasted cars, not burnt cars, because they're not necessarily burnt. We don't know what happened to them, but we know they're toast. They're history. You know, you can't fix it. You got to go get another one. It's, you know, it's toast. It's history. So that's what I mean by toasted cars. And these cars that looked to be going into spontaneous combustion, they just suddenly went in what looked to be flames. I'm not going to assume they're flames, but this happened all around shortly after various events occurred. And, you know, like the dust cloud rolls out from Tower 1's demise, and then the cars lit up. And we know that timing because the various firefighters would say, you know, the dust, you know, went up, it blocked out 100% of the sunlight. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. But then, thank goodness, the car in front of them just lit up because then they could see where they were. So we know the cars, quote, lit up right after the dust went, you know, blocked out the sunlight. Blocked it out for, you know, several minutes at least. So there's this strange phenomenon that it appeared to be fire, but, you know, hot things glow, but everything glows as hot. Plastic may not have been melted around, like, window trim, yet the paint looked blistered up. Just strange things occurring. And it's some as far as, you know, a quarter mile or half mile away were seen going into spontaneous combustions. One thing kind of interesting with the car park, that it sounded like somebody shooting a gun. And it turns out some police had extra bullets in his glove box, and the bullets started exploding. It sounded like gunfire. Yeah. That's kind of interesting. So this is a strange phenomenon. Next to the cars, you know, there's trees that didn't look burned at all. There's paper that didn't burn. There's buildings that didn't get toasted. Just the vehicles. I'm not talking about absolutely every square inch of the whole city. I'm talking about there are pictures where the cars appear to go in spontaneous combustion and nothing around them. That's weird. So what do we have that's consistent with this? And you also notice the tires go away, but when the wheel rim drops to the pavement, it seems to have stopped the effect, whatever it is, as though it was grounded then. You start thinking, yeah, cars are up on rubber tires. They're grounded. They're not grounded. And it doesn't mean not grounded at all, but they can build up a charge and not be able to discharge it fast enough. And the similar thing when you look at the towers. The different distance from the top to the ground, yeah, it's grounded, but it can build up a charge faster than it can discharge it, with the exception of, like, the TV antenna. But you bet that was super grounded.
Hey, can I ask a sideline? Yeah. Hold that thought. Sideline question. Motorcycles aren't grounded to the extent cars are. Is my perception correct? Yeah, I was out there in a lightning storm. So I'm saying, it's better to be in a car at that in that circumstance in terms of grounding.
Well, cars are further off the ground than the motorcycle is. But you know, you also are you contact the ground or not? I just wouldn't want to be riding in a thunderstorm.
Yes, it makes me uncomfortable. Okay, well, go ahead.
Here's another fun tidbit. Remember that ambulance parked in front of the towers that survived? Sure. Nothing else did? I'm willing to bet that when ambulances park, you know, if they're going to be loading and unloading passengers who might have heart problems, they probably have a thingy that drops down and grounds them to the ground. And it may have been it could have made the difference. I'm just saying possibility. And I do know that it's part of the regulations for ambulance design, the grounding issue, because of, jumper cables for starting people's hearts and so forth. So here we have this issue of grounding. So if the top of the towers is the furthest away from the ground, they're going to be building up a charge faster than they can discharge. With exception of maybe the core comms, they're so beefy that they probably, have better connection to the ground. So if there's any part of that building that's going to survive from being able to discharge faster, as fast as it's building up the charge, wouldn't you expect to be the core columns?
Yes.
Especially right next to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Anchored.
Right. And I wonder if that was the issue with the, those remaining core columns that were about 700 feet tall that suddenly went poof. After, a delayed effect when there was probably more charge available.
A delay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. This is just looking at observations. I had also asked John Hutchison, who can replicate every single one of these effects, if when he's running his gizmo, if there's some issue with grounding, he says, this is before he knew what the evidence was that I was talking about. He said, things that aren't grounded build up the charge faster. And you get toasted. So start applying that to why tornadoes like trailer parks. They're not as well grounded as regular houses.
They don't have
big sewer pipes and stuff going down. They are grounded, but not as heavily grounded, so they can build up a charge faster than they can discharge. And like the trailers. Last year in the Texas tornadoes, you have a big metal box on rubber tires. And you don't see, dumpsters and stuff going up. You just see the truck trailers going up. Mm. So that seems to be a consistent thing. And, you think of that more Oklahoma. If tornadoes have gone through there before and you don't have basements on these houses and they immediately rebuild, it probably is something similar to that. And as well, So understanding
Conventional teaching or the establishment analysis of tornadoes? Is there something missing here that involves the static fields and some kind of electromagnetic phenom interference that really underlies tornadoes that we don't know about, or we the public?
Yeah, they used to say, straw would stick in trees because of X, Y, and Z, but they've realized that doesn't explain it. They don't, and so they shrug their shoulders now officially in the official things. But now looking at all of these things we've looked at in common with, what builds up a charge, and if you, like the underground of the World Trade Center was not destroyed. I'm not saying zero damage. I'm saying it was not destroyed. It pretty much stopped at ground level. There's something magical about that, except for the few outer wheat checks and the core column sticking up. So it was just taken right down to the ground, but not below ground. You didn't see dustification down in the basement for the most part. And all this is consistent. So let's back up here. Now, how does Hutchison do the parallel evidence to all of this? Which he also finds that something not grounded well builds up a charge faster than it can discharge. What he does is create a static field, and within that static field, he interferes various radio frequency signals, for example, microwave. Now, okay, let's look at weather events. It's normal in the Midwest to have storm systems moving through and get tornadoes. Head to the southwest corner of your basement, right? That's usually where it's coming from. And that's been normal for eons. But then suddenly in 2008, there was a sort of a step function in you start getting these supersized tornadoes and really super duper weather events. Well, if you normally have the storm system moving through the Midwest, you have a static field around the storm systems. You know, people say they can feel a storm coming because it's a different electricity in the air that they can sense. And if you have this static field and then it interferes with radio frequency signals, could be unintended consequences, but you're fixing to mess up. Something's going to happen. And television went from analog to, they required everyone to switch to digital beginning, I think it was February 2009. So the summer of 2008, they were finishing up putting in brand new radio frequency transmission towers, for the digital television. So here you have a step function of radio frequency transmission towers going up all over the place, and you have the normal weather events in the Midwest, this, storm system moving through. You're going to have unintended consequences. It's fixing to mess up. And that deal in VB, Arkansas, where the birds fell out of the sky, they exhibited a lot of the similar effects. Something weird that happened there. And the blob on the satellite image, I downloaded them. The blob didn't move, even though the storm system was moving. So if there's a radio signal traversing that zone that where the storm system moved through, and it was just mixture, probably would have had that effect in a certain volume of space, certain length of time. The evidence is consistent with that. It's not absolute proof, but the evidence is very consistent with that. And if that didn't happen then, it's bound to happen at some point because it's a problem waiting to happen. Okay, now we come, drum roll, the final straw. So we had this static field around Manhattan on 9/11. We don't know if it was used or how it was used, but there was a static field there because we had thunder record at the three major airports surrounding Manhattan, JFK, LaGuardia, and Newark airports. And there happened to be this hurricane just offshore. Well, that's inconvenient to have a hurricane there if that's what you're using it for, to get the static field. Instead, now let's think of, instead of having a storm system produce a static field, what other kind of fields might you have everywhere? Smart meters. If you have smart meters.
Tell us what a smart meter is.
We're getting more and more wireless signals around. We're getting, cell phone wireless, and my router went belly up, and I need to get a new one. I went to China Mart, and they only had wireless ones. I wanted a wired one. And it's really getting hard to find wired-only equipment that doesn't put out wireless signals. And if we're filling the air with wireless signals, what on earth are we doing? Making this so you don't have to wait for a storm system to move through. charging the atmosphere with all sorts of signals. And if we know for a fact that if Hutchison can reproduce all these effects that happened on 9/11, he can reproduce those in his lab by, his evidence is create a static field and within that interfere various radio frequency signals and you get these weird effects. What are we doing to our environment? The smart meters do that.
But give me the what is a smart meter? Is this connected or part of any wireless?
Yes. Instead of your electric meter on your house wired to the electric company, because it taps off the electric line that feeds your house. And they have a meter that shows how much electricity you've used, and you get billed for it. Instead of coming out to your house to read your meter, they just read it back remotely. It sends a signal to the office.
Okay. So it's just one more of these wireless signal systems that's out there.
Yeah, but it is interesting, right? But why are they requiring it on every house? And not just in the United States. In England now. And there's some people who are very sensitive to the field effects from these wireless, smart meters, they call them, that they've moved out in the boondocks, up on some mountain somewhere, and they've been required at gunpoint to get a smart meter. So to the point they've say, just unplug it. I don't want it, electricity then. I'll find some solar panels or something. Why is it that
So that would suggest something nefarious that were not just unanticipated consequences.
It needs some explaining that nobody seems to be looking at. And we do know for a fact what mixing these signals can do. If it is unintended consequences, then accidentally somebody's going to dustify the whole planet? If it is unintended consequences, everybody better wise up and say, wait a minute, we got to look what we're doing before we do it.
Yeah, you would think somebody would have thought about this in the engineering community earlier, huh? But Judy Wood's the pioneer.
This is not a theory. This is, let's look at the parallel evidence produced by John Hutchison. The reason why I look to Hutchison's work is I don't have to rely on a textbook, and stories. Tesla died before I was born. So that's a story. But Hutchison, I go to his lab. I went there. I watched. I experienced in person. I know what exists. So that's something in the here and now that is demonstrated in front of me. So I know that this is a real effect. And so if you have a static field interfere radio frequency signals within that static field, you're fixing a mess up. And so smart meters all over the country or the planet, you're fixing a mess up in a big way, in a really big way.
Free energy of a destructive, uncontrolled kind, I gather, instead of a benign free energy.
Let me add to that. The title of my book, that's another distortion that my detractors often say, she said a free energy device was used. No, there's evidence of what happened on 9/11 that energy was directed in such a way as to do what was done. But that energy being directed in that way, it could also be directed in a different way to put out good, to put out free energy for people. So yeah. The evidence shown on 9/11 is also a demonstration that free energy technology exists. It's however it's used,
is.
Whatever you call it.
Okay, I gather we are near the end of the Reynolds Reveal, episode 19. Is that correct? The clock on the wall suggested.
Sorry we didn't get back to Ryan, but hopefully we answered his questions.
If not, we're going to make another go at it in a month or so. I got to have Dr. Judy back on the Reynolds Reveal. So please listen up next week for the Reynolds Reveal. I won't be in Lexington. I'll be home, and it'll all be smoother and nicer. And I'll have Where Did the Towers Go on the shelf, Dr. Wilson. Thank you for coming on the Reynolds Reveal.